Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What a week. No deal for Detroit and a political crime spree alleged in Illinois. U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald of Scooter Libby fame was back on stage, guns blazing. He said Governor Rod Blagojevich was hawking Barack Obama's vacated seat.
The governor's own words describing the Senate seat, quote, "It's a bleeping valuable thing, you just don't give it away for nothing."
The auto bailout bill failed in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said there will be hell to pay.
Millions of Americans, not only the auto workers, but people who sell cars, car dealerships, people who work on cars, are going to be directly impacted and affected.
But Senate Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell said Detroit brought the woe on itself.
None of us want to see them go down. But very few of us had anything to do with the dilemma that they've created for themselves.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Is this the end for Detroit? A new beginning? And how big, how bad is the bruise of Blagojevich? Joining us today from New York is Chrystia Freeland, U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times. Chrystia, welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Good to have you. And with us, our old Chicago friend, Laura Washington, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. She's at WLRN in Miami today. We'll have to ask if she fled Chicago in shame. Laura, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Oh, boy. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chrystia, and Laura.
The dateline is right off Air Force One now. The White House is considering using money from the Wall Street bailout package to rescue Detroit automakers, but we don't know at this hour what may happen with that. Jack, you were watching last night. What did you see on the Senate floor?
Well, it was clear that the Republican senators, most from the South, who were voting against this, had a combination of ideological or principled motives and local economic motives. The principal motives were an aversion to what one senator, Senator DeMint of South Carolina, called the barnacles of unionism around the necks of an American industry, and a particular aversion to the UAW, which has spent money to defeat many of these senators. And then the parochial aspect came with senators like Shelby from Alabama, who said this isn't a national problem, the collapse of these, potential collapse of these car companies. It's a Michigan, an upper Midwest problem. Of course, that's very arguable indeed. And again and again, you could sense that the idea of lowering the wages of the UAW to bring it down about $10 an hour to levels charged to what the foreign manufacturers pay in the South, that the idea behind that was, well, then that would make the foreign manufacturers proof against UAW organizing drives, because, of course, there'd be no benefit to joining the union if you paid the same wage. And again, you saw the Southern senators defending the foreign car manufacturers and state, narrowly understood state interest against the idea that this could be in the national interest to save the auto companies. What they were doing, Barbara Boxer of California charged, was playing, quote, Russian roulette with the recession, because, of course, if the car companies do go down, that's going to do nothing but make the recession worse.
Maybe. We'll see. We're in the midst of big, big stuff here. Let's get a flavor of that conversation with all the chips on the table on Capitol Hill. Here yesterday, Senator Christopher Dodd, Democrat, Connecticut, warned that if the auto industry is not bailed out, it will, the U.S. industry, disappear.
We are looking at least one, maybe two, of the three automobile manufacturers that have existed for almost a century in our country. At a time of great economic peril, when the confidence and optimism of our country is at risk, we run the risk over these days of watching this industry disappear.
Senator John Ensign, Republican, Nevada, said bankruptcy might not be a bad option for the automakers.
Venerable companies in America, such as Macy's and Continental Airlines, have filed for Chapter 11 and have emerged as stronger, more viable companies. So why should the big three be treated any differently?
And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, Kentucky, saying yesterday that the bailout's creation of a car czar, we've talked about that right here this week, to oversee the bailout, would miss the point of long-term reform, he said, and he said would not address big union contracts.
A primary weakness relates to the so-called car czar, who has nearly unlimited power to allocate taxpayer dollars, but limited ability to force the kind of tough concessions that long-term viability would require.
Mitch McConnell in the Senate yesterday. Chrystia Freeland at the Financial Times. This is about as big as financial news gets when it comes to the auto industry. You have not been so hot on the bailout. How are you feeling now, Chrystia?
I continue to be skeptical, actually, and I do think that the point about the prepackaged Chapter 11, that clip that you aired, mm-hmm. was really well made.
What does that mean? People talk about a prepackaged Chapter 11, and I'm not sure it's clear what it would mean.
Well, what it would mean would be that these companies would go into a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. That's different from a Chapter 7, which is liquidation. In Chapter 11, companies continue to operate. Tribune has been a recent example of a company that did that. The prepackaged element would mean that big parts of the deal of how the company would operate would be worked out in advance, and probably in the case of the car companies, you would have significant government support as part of that prepackaging. Probably what's called DIP financing to help the companies continue to be able to secure credit to operate going forward.
But bankruptcy, because that would be a crowbar here. That would force concessions that a car czar, critics were concerned, would not, could not.
That's right. In bankruptcy, you would have a bankruptcy judge who runs the procedure, and the bankruptcy judge would start with tremendous power because all existing contracts would be abrogated. And it's not just a question of the unions. We ran an op-ed piece in the Financial Times today by Joe Stiglitz, who is a mm-hmm. Nobel Prize-winning economist and very much a voice on the left. Mm-hmm. And he is strongly in favor of Chapter 11, precisely because he thinks this bailout is a bailout to save Wall Street, the bailout plan. And in particular, he is concerned that the creditors would be unfairly rescued by U.S. taxpayers. I think that's absolutely right. I think that the holders of equity in these companies deserve to be wiped out, and the creditors deserve to be put on a very, very insecure footing, as they would be in Chapter 11.
Laura Washington.
That's what would help the companies actually emerge much stronger from the process.
We'll look at that. And Laura, we want to get with you to Blagojevich, but mm-hmm. Detroit's just around the corner from your Chicago. The industry that starts there spreads all over your region. Harry Reid saying, you know, it's going to be a very, very bad Christmas for a lot of people. I suppose there are a lot of ways to skin this cat. The White House may still end up in the middle of it. But what about the tremors from this last night through that upper Midwest where this industry is so big, Laura?
Well, we have a couple of major auto plants in the Chicago area. As a matter of fact, a Saturn plant, which is on the far south side and south mm-hmm. suburbs of Chicago, which also happens to be a U.S. Representative Jesse Jackson Jr.'s district. I talked to him about this a week or so ago, and there were tens of thousands of jobs that were at stake in that area alone. So, of course, you know, people in Chicago are very concerned about this. They're looking. They're looking very tremulously at this. I think one of the things that strikes me is the whole union aspect of it. I'm not an expert, but it seems mm-hmm. that the unions have an issue here, and they have not really completely stepped up to the plate, and they're really resisting, any kinds of concessions. And even in a union town like Chicago, I think a lot of people are looking askance at that.
Chrystia, how do you read the UAW's refusal to play ball? They were put on the spot last night. They were asked to make big, big concessions. Republicans said, as I'm reading it, if they did that, they could have come through with $14 billion. UAW said no. How do you interpret that? Why? With everything at stake here, Chrystia.
Well, I am partly in agreement with Laura. I mean, the UAW did make some big concessions earlier this year.
Yes.
And they made some concessions earlier in this process of discussion of the Detroit bailout. So they haven't been totally standing on the sidelines. Having said that, I do think they're going to have to make deeper concessions. The reason that I think a Chapter 11 bankruptcy would be a good idea is it would give comfort to all the parties that are making concessions that everyone is having to give way. And I do think that it's unfair to solely target the unions. I think the dealers are a real legacy problem for Detroit, and they're going to have to be trimmed. And as I was saying before, I think the creditors are really going to have to make really significant contributions to whatever is the ultimate package.
Jack, how do you read the pressures on the White House now? Everything is on them. They've got some of that $700 billion that was carved out for Wall Street, though a lot of it's already committed. In the back half of it, that $350 billion, the White House might have to go back to Congress to get sign-off on that. They've got $15 billion left, I think, but it's more or less spoken for the first $350. I mean, what about the political pressures around George W. Bush and his administration here, Jack?
Well, I don't think George W. Bush wants to be known as the president who effectively destroyed the post-war American industrial base. I just don't think so. And if this is a matter of just $15 billion to kick this albatross down the road, it would seem to me that he has every reason to do that.
But nobody thinks that's the end of it, $15 billion.
I'm just speaking about his part.
Off his watch.
Yeah, on his watch. He can't want that to go along with the other string of failures, disasters, and disappointments that really have made up his regime.
Unbelievable.
I absolutely agree with Jack, if I may, Tom. I absolutely agree with him. I think that part of the reason that there's been a reluctance from the White House and from the Treasury to do that is it would mean that the Treasury would have no cushion at all if we were to see some sort of new unexpected problem in the financial sector.
What about the other $350 billion? Can't they
get
to
that
through
Congress? They would have to get approval. But they wouldn't have any sort of overnight capacity to go in as they did with Citi just a few weeks ago.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The Senate says no to Detroit super corruption allegations in Illinois. Jobs keep dropping. Laura Washington is with us from the Chicago Sun-Times. Chrystia Freeland, U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times, is here, and our own Jack Beatty. We are not finished talking about this Detroit situation, I promise you, but I want to get Blagojevich on the table. What an unbelievable series of announcements and back and forth and picture this week. Here's U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald in his press conference for the ages announcing the arrest that morning of the Illinois governor. He begins in pretty dramatic fashion.
It's a very sad day for Illinois government. Governor Blagojevich has taken us to a truly new low. Governor Blagojevich has been arrested in the middle of what we can only describe as a political corruption crime spree. We acted to stop that crime spree. The most appalling conduct Governor Blagojevich engaged in, according to the complaint filed today or unsealed today, is that he attempted to sell the Senate seat.
Mess all over in the wake of that. Here's just one Illinois Congressman, Jesse Jackson Jr., at his own press conference on Wednesday. Tough scene there, denying any involvement in Blagojevich's attempt to sell that seat. The U.S. Attorney's complaint suggested that an unidentified candidate number 5 was prepared to give $1 million maybe for the seat.
I never sent a message or an emissary to the governor to make an offer, to plead my case, or to propose a deal about a U.S. Senate seat, period.
Laura Washington, this is your town, your governor, your Senate seat. What do you make of this?
Well, first, you know, what everyone's been asking me this week is, am I shocked or Chicagoans shocked? And I got to tell you, we're not really shocked about the idea that there's graft and corruption going on in Cook County and Chicago and Illinois.
But at this level, for this seat, the president-elect seat?
The corruption is we're talking about Cook County, which is also known as Crook County. Mm. We're talking about a place where there was a book that was written once that used the title, quoting an old-time ward healer, "We don't want nobody sent." This is a state and a city where doing deals behind scenes, doing favors for people is part of doing business in politics, and voters expect a certain amount of graft and corruption. That having been said, I think the shock level here is the breathtaking extent of Blagojevich's commentary, the hubris, the cynicism,
he's
sitting there saying, what can I get for this? Can I get a job for myself? Can I get maybe some work for my wife? Can I get maybe somebody could make me the head of a foundation? Maybe I can run this union organization. The fact that he would just sit freely and openly with a number of people in the room, a number of people on the telephone, and try to buy and sell a Senate seat, I think that's what got everybody really going.
Now, Fitzgerald.
Isn't that astonishing?
Christia, please, yes.
I was going to say, the thing that surprised me, Laura, was he knew he was under investigation. Surely if you want to be sleazy when someone is investigating you, you go have a walk in the park when you try to do these deals rather than do them over the phone.
Absolutely, and Christia, and that's why there's a lot of folks, you know, I mean, this is not the kind of thing you engage in lightly when you're talking about a sitting governor, but a lot of people are saying the guy may be mentally ill and there may be some serious illness going on here, because you certainly don't. He knew he was under investigation. He's been under investigation for 4 years. He knew that there were folks in his own administration who had gone down. He knew that there were people watching him, and yet he felt it was he felt comfortable. Not only you say not only just not doing it when he was in a closed room, but doing it, talking about it with a number of folks, and then extending that conversation outside the room, sending emissaries to go to other folks who were not even part of his administration to make these deals.
Jack, we don't know if he's guilty, but it sure sounds bad. Laura raises the prospect that he's crazy, mentally ill.
Yeah, I've been looking at some of those adjectives being used by Chicago journalists, and, you know, sociopath, psychopath, a screw loose, on and on. Yeah, it does look bad. You know, this blatant boodler forgot the admonition of Martin Lemazni. He's the famous Boston ward boss of the turn of the century, and he said, "Don't write when you can talk. Don't talk when you can whisper. Don't whisper when you can nod. Don't nod when you can blink." And unfortunately, Mr. Blagojevich forgot about that.
Let's get a little more.
There's a certain logic to it, too. For example, he is, according to the federal charges, he is saying on the tape at one point, they're talking about who they might pick for the Senate seat. He's talking to his chief of staff. And the chief of staff says, "Well, would you like me to make a list?" And he says to him, "Oh, no, you don't want to put this in writing." But yet, again, he's having multiple conversations with multiple people whom he doesn't have a trust relationship with about the same thing. It's crazy. It's totally illogical.
And we've all heard it now, bleeping, bleeping, bleeping. Let's go to Dan in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Dan, what do you see here?
Hey, I see that there's no crime. You know, what it is at worst, what it is Chicago politics gone downstate. I grew up in the Mayor Daley area, Richard J., you know, this is not anything new. Okay?
No crime? He's saying, how about half a million? How about a million?
Hey, the FBI has blown its hand. It has no case because, as far as I can tell, now, of course, I'm not on the inside, but as far as I can tell, no money has changed hands. No jobs have actually, you know, he hasn't gone to work for anybody. I mean, it might be incredibly poor taste, might be incredibly poor judgment. But if I remember correctly, you know, I'm 30 years away from Chicago, maybe, and looking at things a little differently. But he can't run for another term anyhow. You know, it's two terms.
Oh, no, he can't. He can't. He can't. He is free to run. Whether he will run is another question, but he can run for another term.
Neither as it may. The FBI has blown its wad, I think. I think they have no case because they don't have a single dollar. They don't have a single piece of consideration. They have a guy that maybe is flapping his trap.
Lower Washington, how about it? Patrick Fitzgerald said they had a crime spree underway here. They were afraid that a kind of off-the-hook governor was going to name this thing, and a deal might be done, maybe other deals as well. But I haven't seen a pic. You know, there's no photograph of cash in the hand. Mm-hmm. Where's the line here? Do they have this stuff? Does it look like a strong case, despite how vivid?
I think there's a couple of things. Patrick Fitzgerald is an extremely careful, methodical prosecutor. So you've got to believe that if he thought he had to go early, and he's admitted himself that he went early with this set of charges because he felt there was criminal activities underway. He did it because he sincerely believed that. Having said that, Scott Turow, the well-known novelist who's himself a former federal prosecutor and knows Chicago politics and the legal system better than anybody else, wrote in the New York Times earlier this week that he felt that Fitzgerald, as the caller points out, may have dealt his cards too early, may have wounded himself in terms of his own prosecution because he's laid his cards out on the table now and he's opened himself to moving prematurely and not having had a chance to gather enough evidence before all the criminals start scurrying. So he's in a position now where he's got to go early on a case that he wasn't ready to go on. And then there is the question of what what criminal activity was really underway. And I've heard a number of legal experts say the same thing that the caller has said, that it's one thing to sit around and talk about and muse about, I'd like to do this, I'd like to do that. Was money exchange hands? Was a deal made? And was there a direct quid pro quo that you can prove? And I don't know that I've seen enough evidence to support that yet.
Though we'll hear a lot about where the line exactly lies here. Solicitation, what about that? Let's go to Lanny in Sebula, Iowa. Lanny, you're on the air.
Well, hi there, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just calling. I'm always amazed by the surprise in your voice when something happens in Chicago. I sit out here in Iowa, and we read the Tribune, and they either report on or allude to things like that. And I've got a daughter there in Chicago. I get into town now and then. But with the governor, it's just been a matter of degree.
Now, wait, Lanny. I hear you. I'm an Illinois kid downstate. We all know Chicago isn't exactly patty cake. But when you heard that tape, didn't it make your hair stand on end, even so?
Oh, no, it made me laugh out loud. It's great theater, Tom.
Okay.
Everybody wants to make fun of Chicago. It's a favorite whipping boy. I want to remind you that there was a study out of USA Today this week that looked at the level of corruption, and the measurement they used was a number, the proportion of elected officials that had been convicted over a certain period of time. And Chicago came in, the state of Illinois came in 17th among the 50 states. And I think it was either South Dakota or North Dakota came in number one. So we couldn't be all that bad.
Maybe. On the other hand, maybe Governor Ryan read that sitting already in prison. I want to get closer to this, the Obama angle on this, because it doesn't seem like it's going away right away, even though, well, here's Fitzgerald addressing the issue of Blagojevich trying to involve the Obama circle. Fitzgerald said Blagojevich wanted a three-way deal kind of with the governor, getting a high-paid job, maybe a union job, Obama installing a favorite candidate in the union, maybe getting a favor from Obama.
I should make clear the complaint makes no allegations about the president-elect whatsoever, his conduct. This part of the scheme lost steam when the person that the governor thought was the president-elect's choice of senator took herself out of the running. But after the deal never happened, this is the governor's reaction. Quote, "They're not willing to give me anything but appreciation. Bleep them." Close quote.
Okay, close quote. They got nowhere with that one. But, Laura, what about it? Barack Obama's been very, very firm but very careful in his statements on all this week.
Very lawyerly, as a matter of fact.
Yes, indeed.
The first time he said something at a press conference, I think it was on Tuesday, he said, he said, "We were not aware," and then he caught himself and he said, "I was not aware." Again, he's making the distinction between what he knew and what his organization knew, what the transition organization knew. And he has since said, of course, yesterday that he is launching an internal investigation. He's going to find out what conversations were had, entrees were made to or among his staff, and he's going to issue a full written report when he gets to the bottom of it. But it's clear, I think, by inferring things that were in the charges and things that his people have already said, that there were some conversations. Now, whether or not those, it was the kind of thing where Blagojevich's people came and they were rebuffed, whether or not there was specific things discussed, we have to see. But, I think that it's going to be beyond belief that there was not some conversation that happened with someone close to Barack Obama, because all of these people, I mean, people like Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, has a long time relationship with Blagojevich and many people in Blagojevich's administration. David Axelrod says he has not spoken to Blagojevich in many years, but I'm sure he speaks a lot to folks that are close to Blagojevich. It's hard to believe that there weren't some conversations there.
Here's President-elect Obama yesterday at his press conference threading through this, saying his team had remained outside. Well, you got to listen very carefully to what he says, talking about the investigation of Governor Blagojevich.
I have not been contacted by any federal officials, and we have not been interviewed by them. As is reflected in the U.S. Returning's report, we were not, perceived by the governor's office as amenable to any deal making. I won't quote back some of the things that were said about me. This is a family program, I know.
Barack Obama, Jack, he says, "I have not been contacted. We have not been interviewed." I mean, it did sound as though the response was all they would give was their appreciation. That sounds like a pretty clean bill of health, but it's complicated. You could have conversations, I suppose, that were about that were about political dickering that were not illegal, Jack.
Oh, certainly. Embarrassing, potentially embarrassing for the Obama team is the discrepancy with David Axelrod. He said shortly after the election that the campaign had been, I think he even said the candidate, but certainly he said the campaign.
He did say Obama, yes.
He did say Obama. Obama had been in contact with the governor, and now he's walked back and said he misspoke when he said that. Well, that's a discrepancy, and why was he so sure then? And it could well be, Tom, because, in fact, that was a wholly innocent communication. For example, if he picked up the phone and said, you know, Valerie Jarrett is my candidate, and I hope you'll give her every consideration, there's nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, that's just, he is the president-elect. It is his Senate seat. He's got a right to his opinion, and he's got a right to lobby the governor, by way of argument, for his candidate.
Let's get a call from Rich in Cohasset, Massachusetts. Rich, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good.
Good. I moved out here a couple years ago from Chicago, so yeah. Rod was my congressman for a while, too. Unbelievable.
Lucky you.
Yeah, lucky me. But I actually had a question for Laura. I got an email from a good friend of mine in Chicago a couple days ago citing something from Chicago Business.
Crane Chicago
Journal.
Business?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. An article by Greg Heintz, basically
right.
Suggesting that this whole thing got started a couple weeks ago when someone from Blago's group contacted someone in the Obama camp about, you know, maybe making something happen for his preferred Senate candidate, and that this whole thing got rolling because a couple weeks back Obama basically dropped a dime to Fitzgerald, and that basically at the same time, that's when Valerie Jarrett, who everyone had considered the, maybe perhaps the number one candidate, immediately said, hey, I'm not interested anymore, because they knew this whole thing was going down. Is that the kind of thing that you were hearing going around Chicago, or do you believe that is accurate?
Let us look. There must be every scenario under the sun. What about that one? Obama dropped the dime, Laura.
That's a very predominant belief, and I have not seen the Obama people directly deny that. I mean, they've been very artful, you know, talking about, you know, we haven't been interviewed, as you know, as Obama said earlier in that bite.
But Obama saw something going wrong himself, or his team did, and put Fitzgerald onto it.
That's the theory, and there is something to the whole Valerie Jarrett scenario, in that there was a very abrupt moment in all the discussion and speculation about her. She was being entertained. Her name, I brought her name up several times in my column. A lot of people were pushing her, and she was not saying no to that. And my sources tell me she was very interested in the opportunity. And all of a sudden, boom. They announce, oh, well, Valerie's not interested in that because she's going to be on our team.
Mm-hmm.
So it does raise the question as whether or not there was a moment where Obama's people decided they needed to get her name off that list and pull her out of this because of something untoward.
Christia, how do you think the president-elect looks so far in this scandal?
Well, I agree with Laura and Jack that there are a few tricky moments for him and his team, particularly around that Axelrod comment. But overall, I would have to say, especially if you step back a little bit, my prevailing feeling is astonishment that Obama has managed to emerge from this incredibly seemingly slimy world of Chicago politics with his reputation and his character so intact. You know, I think so far, on balance, we have to judge him really quite well. I think it also says something about the political skill he must have had in his early years. Mm. If you remember, particularly during the primaries when he was up against Hillary Clinton, some commentators were accusing Obama of being a Bambi-like figure, a little bit too gentle, not tough enough. Mm-hmm. And if he could survive Chicago, he must have some toughness in there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Snow down south, black humor, and holiday greetings this week. Snow from Georgia to Louisiana.
It is beautiful. Now, I just talked to my daughter. She's in Baton Rouge. covered in snow. The trees are covered in snow. It is sticking to the ground, and it's just beautiful.
And way down south, Jay Leno had a better idea for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich.
They said he was willing to do anything for money. That's why he was going to sell the Senate seat. See, that is so wrong. You know, in this country, let me tell you something. If you want money, you do what everybody else does, okay? You go to Congress, and you demand a bailout. That's what we do.
And Muslims celebrated Eid from Mecca to Michigan. Here's a YouTube video of kids near Dearborn saying in Arabic, "Have a bountiful, generous holiday."
Eid Mubarak! Eid Mubarak!
Oh.
Eid Kareem!
Eid Kareem!
Eid Mubarak!
There's the sound of Michigan. We're looking at a week in the news with Christian Freeland of the Financial Times, Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Bethel, Vermont, and Robert. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, all. Hi. Hey, regarding the car situation, I think the American people should send thank you notes to each of the senators that voted the bailout down last night. And I think that the country and the car manufacturers have to wake up and go as either
Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Are you sure, though, Robert? Are you sure this is not going to come back and bite you, even sitting in Bethel, Vermont, somehow through the whole economy?
Well, Tom, I think we all have to take some pain, and this might be a lot, but I think if the government gets involved more so, like they did with the banking industry, and really debacled that, I just think it will be better for the American people and the American car companies to go into bankruptcy, whether prepackaged, and a contingency in the prepackaged agreement. I think that the three CEOs and the United Auto Workers' head should be beheaded.
Well, so you're ready to take the licks in Vermont. Let's hear from Michigan, Lansing, Michigan, and Kate. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I live in Lansing, Michigan, and so I have been following the discussions pretty closely.
I'm sure you have.
Yesterday, although I'm retired, I'm not attached to the car industry at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday on public radio from U of M, there was a call-in program with a guy from the Center for Automotive Research,
yep,
which is an independent research and not affiliated with the Big Three, and they've been pretty critical of the Big Three. I think what has not been understood at all is the effect on suppliers. Any one vehicle requires 6,000 parts, and if you're missing one, you can't build the car. There are first, second, and third tier suppliers. Some mom and pop employ 15 people, 100 people. Those are some of the creditors right now. In fact, I think the New York Times, there was a small article about this today.
Creditors who might get croaked in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. What's the view from Lansing on a bankruptcy proceeding? Chapter 11, Kate.
I think it's ridiculous. You know, I would buy an airline ticket from an airline in Chapter 11, but I'm not going to make a commitment. I'm driving a 15-year-old Saturn, and I was looking at buying a new car. I'm not going to buy one from a company in Chapter 11. And by the way, those suppliers supply not just the Big Three, but also Toyota, Honda, other manufacturers in this country.
Yeah, we know it, Kate, and we appreciate the witness from right there in Michigan. Christian Freeland, what about it? You like the Chapter 11 prepackaged bankruptcy path, but let's help us understand what that looks like to you. Does it mean like a lot of blood in the streets, but you think it's the only way to get through this or not?
Well, I think the carts are, if he or she operated properly, would also mean some blood in the streets. So I do think that, you know, the problems with the economy mean no matter what, every single company in the country is going to have problems. And if you think specifically about the car companies, even if they're given money to keep on producing a lot of cars, the reality is people aren't buying cars. They're also not buying Toyotas and Hondas. They've had a huge collapse in sales,
right,
too.
Right.
So there is going to be a contraction. And with the American car companies, there's also going to be, and there needs to be, a structural contraction. The fact is they produce too many cars. They produce too many models. They have too many dealers. Speaking about the suppliers, I was speaking to someone who recently left the board of one of these companies, and he said one of their biggest problems is they don't have enough common parts across their vehicles. They have a different ashtray, for example,
right,
in many different models of car. So there does have to be a contraction within these companies, within the suppliers. And I think, you know, the balancing act that the politicians need to perform right now is to figure out what you need to do in terms of life support, what you need to do in terms of preventing the broader economy from getting another body blow that really, you know, perhaps tips it over the edge into a depression, versus the more medium-term work to try to have a viable industry. And I do really come back to faulting the heads of these American car companies. I think they have consistently not come in with a realistic restructuring plan. They have really been trying, I think, to play chicken with American politicians and the American people. And the strongest part of their message has been to say, if you don't bail us out, all hell will break loose. And I think what you're hearing, you know, both from a lot of actual, you know, your callers, and also from people in the Senate, is saying that's not good enough for us.
You know,
Jack, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tom, here are headlines from just this week from the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. American food stamp use near all-time high. Hmm. Freight handlers slam on the brakes. Families cut back on daycare as costs and worries rise. Mining giant Rio Tinto slashes job. Newsweek to Slim Magazine. Restaurant jobs like tips shrinking. Longest period of job losses on record. Painful choices on college bills.
Hey, and don't forget NPR layoffs and Bank of America.
Absolutely. Now, if you, you know, Krista's talking about this in terms of the auto industry and its problems, structural problems, to be sure. But if you look upon this bailout or the bridge loan and even perhaps even a $75 billion tag on that as a stimulus package, which of course it is in the context of a recession, it looks a hell of a lot cheaper than the kind of money they're flooding into Wall Street and which isn't going out in loans to people to buy houses. The economic context here, which seems to be working against the car companies and indeed has put them in this bind, is actually one of the justifications for, it seems to me, subsidizing them, at least in the short term.
Laura, there's a huge psychological component here as well. I mean, there has the feeling again this week with these new unemployment figures and wholesale prices down. Maybe we're still going over the cliff economically here, Laura. I don't know how it feels where you are.
Yeah, I think that feeling is there, but I also think that people have not become convinced that that this bailout will keep us from going over the cliff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of talk about depression. There's a lot of talk about gloom and doom. But is anyone laid? I mean, Chris just makes a point about laying out the case for the bailout. Is anybody laid out the case for what will happen specifically? And if we don't do this, I think there's some, even though we're in a very, very bad time economically, I think there's still this false sense of complacency among Americans that, okay, well, the world hasn't ended yet, so maybe it won't. If the world's going to end, we need to be able to convince people that it's really imminent.
Let's hope and assume it won't, but wow, it's wild. Let's go to Wren in Holliston, Massachusetts. Wren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
As a Chicago kid, I'll leave any commentary alone at that point.
Okay.
Let's go to Detroit. It's not just about the unions. They can take some heat, and justifiably, the leaders of the company for the past 20 years have ignored reality for cars. But it's not Upper Michigan. It's not Upper Midwest. You've got GM plants in Ontario, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You've got affiliates in Japan making parts and cars for both Chrysler and GM and Ford, vans that are Mercedes best for Chrysler, Jeeps parts made in Mexico.
All over.
We're not talking Upper Midwest here. We're talking something that has as many tentacles in the economy as Wall Street. And I think it's very short-sighted to treat it as a
just a regional problem.
It's a local problem. Blagojevich is a local problem.
That reaches right out to Washington and around the country that way as well. But, you know, Chrystia, Wren raises an interesting issue here. I mean, Europeans are talking about what to do on Capitol Hill. In the Senate, they were saying, well, nobody else is going to let their auto industry go down. Why should we? It seems to me that the compass readings are all just twirling now. Nobody knows if it's state intervention, which is the way to go, or take the bloody hit and get back to market forces when they left us in such a pickle on this last round. I mean, the kind of basic compass readings of how the economy should be aligned seem twirling, Chrystia.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think there's also really a great questioning going on about what the role of the government in the economy should be. It's been really interesting for me how many people have brought up the Wall Street bailout. And I have to say that when Detroit first started to ask for money, it seemed to me that the consequence of the Wall Street bailout would be that Detroit's case would be almost invincible, and that people would say, well, look, we spent $750 billion to bail out Wall Street. Surely it's only natural justice to spend another $25 or $50 billion to bail out Detroit. It seems to me that actually the opposite case is starting to be made, and that the perceived ineffectiveness of the government in its actions in bailing out Wall Street is making people question, well, how effective can we trust the government to be in bailing out Detroit? So I do think part of the question here is people asking, what exactly should the government be doing? What is the government's competence in figuring out and restructuring the economy? And I think those are good questions to be asking. The tricky thing is the markets really can't wait. And we may see some real friction, not so much between Detroit and the government as between the markets and the government. And I think really interesting will be what happens today and next week to the markets. If we see a huge sell-off, you could see politically the same thing happening that happened with the Wall Street bailout, where you remember the Congress rejected it the first time, but then when you had a huge sell-off, they came back and said, oh, okay, we do see it's Armageddon if we don't grant this money.
Well, and White House Press Secretary Dana Perino already is saying it would be irresponsible, her word, to further weaken the economy by letting the Detroit car companies fail. And again, as we speak, the White House has not stepped in, but indicating it may well.
Chrystia, can I make one point, Tom?
Yeah.
You speak about, Chrystia, government failure. It's the Bush government. Let's be clear about that.
For sure.
And the Center for Public Integrity just released a 125-page report this week on documenting over 125 systemic failures of execution and administration across the federal government. This is a historically incompetent and even careless administration when it comes to running the government. So it isn't government in general, it's this government.
Let's go to Dale.
No, I agree with you, Jack. And
we'll take that agreement and get a call from Marshfield, Vermont. Dale, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. It seemed to me this morning that I spent a couple of hours just going back through Googling and doing a bit of research to remind myself how many times Mitch McConnell and some of the people screaming last night that they had no role in the collapse of the auto industry.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they fought time and time again against raising the CAFE standards and making sure that Detroit produced fuel-inefficient vehicles.
We got SUVs, but he says my hands are clean. And that's, of course, that's earlier than the Bush administration and more than the Bush administration. I mean, Jack, you know, it may be the Bush government. On the other hand, Americans have thought for a long time, you know, we didn't want to be a country that made Trabants. We didn't want to be a country that had government intervention so deep that we weren't competitive in the world market.
Well, it's true, but, you know, unless we have...
And we ended up that way anyway.
That's right. And you know, we're in a situation governed by what John Maynard Keynes famously called the paradox of thrift. Each of us now is not spending money for all sorts of good reasons. Makes sense for us personally. For the economy, it is ruinous. You know, Bush was scorned for saying after 9/11, go out and shop, take a trip to Disneyland. From the economic point of view, he was absolutely right. And in a case where economy is being the spiraling down, where the paradox of thrift is running full throttle, good for me personally, bad for the economy, and ultimately, of course, bad for me,
The only thing that can start that engine going again is government. Government spending, government intervention. That was Keynes's point then, and it seems to me the necessity for it is clear today.
One little bit of more tape here that may end up being relevant, because especially if the government's involved with Detroit and the cars they're making. President-elect Obama is set to nominate Stephen Chu, Nobel Prize-winning physicist and head of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, as his energy secretary. Here is Dr. Chu speaking at the National Clean Energy Conference in August of this year. Listen to the message of the incoming energy czar, never mind cars czar, saying that climate change could warm the world by perhaps 5 degrees with dire consequences.
The climate change of that scale will cause enormous resource wars over water, arable land, and massive population displacements. We're not talking about 10,000 people. We're not talking about 10 million people. We're talking hundreds of millions to billions of people being flooded out permanently.
Laura Washington, it feels like we're sort of getting all the chips out on the table here as Obama moves into this office. I mean, the climate is there. There's Detroit and American industry there. There's American rectitude there, or lack thereof, via your governor. Wow, what a stack of challenges.
Well, this raises a point I wanted to make about one of the earlier callers who said he said the Blagojevich is a local problem. I beg to differ. The Blagojevich scandal is very much a national problem because it impacts deeply the president-elect, the president-to-be's administration, in the perception of a candidate who stood for election and was elected as standing as an agent for change, as an agent for transparency. Now he's in a position of having to defend whether or not he's just business as usual. And there's also all the agonizing and dickering that's going on over that Senate seat that is still up for grabs in Illinois. That is a U.S. Senate seat, which will be seated in the U.S. Senate. This is not a local problem. This is a problem for all of us.
All interconnected. Laura Washington with the Chicago Sun-Times. Laura, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
Chrystia Freeland, U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. Chrystia, thanks as always for joining us.
Pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being here, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.